While we may be united under one constitution, separate and distinct states remain, each with its own constitution and culture. Geographic idiosyncrasies add more than just local character. Regional understandings of law and justice have shaped and reshaped our nation throughout history. America's Constitution, our founding and unifying document, looks slightly different in California than it does in Kansas, says our next guest. In his new book, The Law of the Land, legal scholar Akhil Reed Amar illustrates how geography, federalism, and regionalism have influenced some of the biggest questions in American constitutional law. Again, the name of the book is The Law of the Land, a grand tour of our constitutional republic. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Akhil Reed Amar to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What got you thinking about this in geographical terms?
Well, I grew up in California and then came out to Yale in New England to study. And so there were interesting similarities and differences between the California culture and the Connecticut culture. I started to study the U.S. Constitution, and it immediately became clear to me, especially from my study of federalism, that ours is a vast republic with 50 separate and distinct states, each with a story to tell, and that the states actually both are similar to the U.S. Constitution, but actually also vary. You look at presidential elections today, and you see stark north-south divides of a sort, very similar to what I see when I study history, when I see the election of 1860, for example, involving Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson versus John Adams back in 1796 and 1800. It's north against south also. There are interesting patterns of coasts against the center. So just as I look out, whether I'm looking in a history book or looking on the television screen or thinking about my own lived experience, it just has seemed to me that from sea to shining sea, ours is a vast republic with some very interesting variation.
And you point this out, but the politics of it are different. The red state, blue state is not as impactful.
Within each state, there are interesting patterns. If you actually go behind pierce the box of these individual states, you'll actually see, if you look, for example, at a presidential election by county, you'll see actually, here's the following pattern today. There's a very thin blue strip. Let's begin in Washington, D.C., work up the Amtrak corridor or all the way up through Baltimore and Wilmington and Philadelphia and New York and Boston, all the way around Maine, the St. Lawrence Seaway, across the Great Lakes, the top tip of Ohio and around Michigan and Minnesota and then down the Mississippi River. That's all a thin strip of blue. The West Coast, you can't go in more than 50 miles, but just the West Coast from Seattle down to San Diego. There are a few Indian reservations that look big on a map that are blue, but not that many people live there. Maybe 10 college towns like Boulder, Colorado, and Atlanta, Georgia, Austin, Texas, and the tip of Miami. And that's blue America. The rest is quite red. So even within states, you look at a state like Ohio, for example, thin strip of blue along the top coast, Columbus, Ohio, the rest largely red.
You make the point of that Amtrak corridor and that strip of also has an impact on our Supreme Court.
Every one of the current justices went to law school at Harvard or Yale. They tended to have gone, today's justices, to fancy colleges as well. For the last, that hasn't always been so. You take the Supreme Court, let's say, back in the 1800s, and let's take maybe the most infamous case of the 19th century, the Dred Scott decision. Well, that was a court dominated by the South. 5 of the 9 justices who issued these outrageous rulings on slavery in America came from the slaveholding region in 1857, even though the slaveholding part of America was only a third of the free population. More than half the justices came from that part, and that's because back in those days, Supreme Court justices didn't just sit on the Supreme Court, they also rode circuit. And the circuit and on lower courts, and the circuits were defined geographically, not functionally, not antitrust lower courts and administrative law lower courts and tax lower courts, but they were geographically defined lower courts, and the Supreme Court justices had to ride circuit. And since actually the roads were really bad down south and the cities were few and far between, each southern circuit actually included a sort of smaller population area than each northern circuit because it was just harder to travel within these southern circuits. So the South got massively overrepresented in the 19th century Supreme Court. Today we don't have circuit riding anymore. We don't have the southern seat formally or the western seat. We do have a system in which, as I said, they all tend to have gone to just a couple of schools, and that may have counterbalanced just a little bit the conservative tendency that would otherwise have been predicted, given that for every one of the last 40 years, the Republicans have had a majority on the Supreme Court. And yet it hasn't been quite as conservative as you might have predicted once I told you that fact. And part of it is, as I said, Harvard and Yale's impact. Part of it is we've had some northern Republicans on the court in ways that we haven't seen in the rest of society. Not that many prominent northern Republicans, Lincoln Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans in the House or Senate or the recent presidency. But, yes, on the Supreme Court, you have kind of northern Lincoln Republicans like David Souter from New Hampshire, John Paul Stevens from Chicago, Harry Blackmun from Minnesota, all retired, but you still have Tony Kennedy from Northern California, and isn't it interesting how he swings in various ways as the Northern Californian on the court.
You talk about Lincoln Republicans. You write about Lincoln in the book and how so many of his views came from his point of view as a Midwesterner. And I'm interested in that concept of how that geographical point of view has such consequences.
So you're in Albany, right?
Right.
Okay, so Lincoln has this powerful connection to Albany because he believes in canals, because he's a hick from the sticks, and he wants to be connected to the world, and he's not going to be connected to the world unless there are railroads and canals. As a president, he's going to try to connect America east to west with a transcontinental railroad, and if you believe in railroads and canals, you need the government to do that, and indeed, if you want to create a national system, you need the federal government to connect this up. A later Lincoln Republican named Dwight Eisenhower is going to promote an interstate highway system for similar reasons. And a Lincoln Republican named Teddy Roosevelt is going to try to create canals, you see, a Panama Canal that will connect east and west. So if you're Lincoln, you understand that and you're from the Midwest, you understand that the entire region from the Appalachians to the Rockies drains to the Mississippi River, and unless you can actually control that river, you can't get your goods to market. You're going to be very skeptical of the idea of a southern republic breaking away from the Union, controlling the lower Mississippi, controlling New Orleans, possibly being able to block that port and your access to the world, to the world's markets. If you're from the Midwest, as Lincoln is, you believe that the federal government actually created the states. If you're from Virginia, you think, well, of course Virginia came first. It's been up since 1620, if you're Robert E. Lee, and all of your great-great relations were running Virginia from the early 1600s on. By the time of the American Revolution, if you're a Virginian, Virginia's 150 years old already. So you think Virginia creates the Union. But if you're Abraham Lincoln, you think that the federal government created these new Midwestern states that out of nothing. They were originally federal territories before they were states, Indiana, Illinois. Lincoln himself is not a state person. He's born in Kentucky. He moves to Indiana, then to Illinois. His father's from Virginia. His grandfather's from Pennsylvania. Before that, he thinks the Lincolns come from New England, although he's not quite sure. He's not quite sure which state within New England. So he's a modern American, and he has a different idea about, again, the relation of the federal government to the states. He's also a big person believing in free soil. That's because the Northwest is free soil. It's free soil even before the Constitution comes along because of this thing called the Northwest Ordinance that says you're never going to have slavery north and west of the Ohio River, which become the states of Illinois and Indiana, for example. The Northwest Ordinance, word for word, its anti-slavery provision will become the 13th Amendment, which Lincoln signed. He doesn't live to see it ratified, but that's taken directly from the Northwest Ordinance. The Northwest Ordinance has this commitment to public education, and Lincoln has this strong commitment to public education. The Morrill Land Grant Act is going to be one of his more important legacies, along with an intercontinental railroad system and resisting Southern secession and promoting freedom rather than slavery. All classically North attitudes characteristic of folks from the old Northwest, Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin. They're the backbone of the Republican Party and of the Union Army. People like Ulysses S. Grant or General Sherman or the great constitutional congressman John Bingham, who drafts Section 1 of the 14th Amendment.
I found it fascinating. In the conclusion, you talk about current, obviously, 2016 presidential politics, current politics, but also the geographical ramifications. You make the point on the Republican side, Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Perry all have strong Texas ties. And then on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton lacks special ties to the key states of Ohio, Florida, and Texas. Nevertheless, she is a genuine regional triple threat, having grown up in the Midwest, served as the first lady of a southern state, and later represented a northeastern state in the U.S. Senate. Also, you talk about her credentials, once again, Wellesley and Yale Law. So these things mean something.
Yes, and let's not forget Florida as a key state. So the states that are particularly decisive in American history in the Electoral College, which, remember, is a geographic system. It depends, whether you become president doesn't hinge solely on how many votes you get, but where they come from. And the swing states in American history have tended to be the states where North meets South. In 1796 and 1800, when the Southerner Jefferson ran against the Northerner Adams twice, the swing state, the state where North meets South, at the time was actually New York, which was a slave state at the time. And as the population moved westward, Ohio becomes this key state. It's where North meets South and East meets West. In the last presidential election, there were only four states that were actually decided by less than 5 percentage points. Four truly purple states. And they're the four states where North meets South, really. Three geographically, Ohio, Virginia, because Washington, D.C. has kind of spread its influence across some of Virginia. So some of Virginia is kind of D.C. beltway. So Ohio, Virginia, and North Carolina. The only other state that was decided by less than 5 points, and on the map it's not where North meets South, but culturally it's where North meets South, is Florida, because all these New Yorkers and New Jersey types retire down there. And so demographically, even if not geographically, it's where North meets South. And they're really important key states, and Florida is one, and Ohio is one. Note that Jeb Bush has a connection to Florida. Texas turns out to be interesting in this story because in the modern era, as population has moved south and west, Texas has become, and California have become particularly significant. So in four sentences, early on, almost all your presidents are Southerners or pro-Southern Northerners, and that's because the Three-Fifths Clause tips the Electoral College toward the South. Lincoln's election is something very new and different. He's a genuine Northerner, anti-slavery, the first openly anti-slavery president, and he wins all the Northern states and loses all the Southern states. And he's unusual because he's the first real Yankee to win in as an anti-slavery guy. But because the South overreacts, secession, the Southerners who would control the presidency don't get another president for the next 100 years. Woodrow Wilson doesn't run as a Southerner. He has Southern roots, but he runs as a New Jersey guy. When Lyndon Johnson, a Texan, champions a Voting Rights Act and a Civil Rights Act, the South actually, there's a massive realignment, and all the recent presidents have really come from the South and West, and Texas is a particularly key part of that. It used to be part of the Democrat coalition, FDR's coalition. His running mate first time around was John Nance Garner from Texas. But in the modern era, the Democrats have lost their lock on Texas, and the Republicans, Texas is a key part of their constituency. In the last presidential, in six of the last nine presidential elections, the Republicans have run a Texan for president or vice president. They won five of those six. They lost every time they didn't have a Texan. So, yes, pay attention to Jeb Bush's birth in Texas and the fact that he went to University of Texas Law School and he's a son of a Texas president and a brother of a Texas president. And Rand Paul was born in Texas, and his dad from Texas ran for president multiple times, Ron Paul. And yes, Ted Cruz is the senator from Texas, and Rick Perry is governor of Texas for a dozen years. So Texas turns out to be really key. These aren't just random, that these are the folks that are being generated. Or Marco Rubio from Florida, because that's key. Don't overlook Ohio and John Kasich and Rob Portman. Maybe interesting vice presidential picks on the Republican side.
It's all fascinating. The book is The Law of the Land, a grand tour of our constitutional republic. It's published by Basic Books. Akhil Rita Marr, thank you so much for sharing with us. And again, really, really interesting. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Again, the title of the book, The Law of the Land, it's published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.